This is Ancient Afterlives. Welcome back to part two of our interview with Ingrid Brulee Gimser, where we continue our discussion on Dead Sea Scrolls and forgeries.
But then, of course, there's the problem that, you know, it's not often that you get a chance to be the first person in the world to touch something, to publish something. Mm-hmm. So of course, if a collector comes and says, you know, oh, I have this material, it's, I want you because you're so talented in this field. I've read your work before. You're great. And I would like for you to be the first person to publish this. Then I think, well, who wouldn't be flattered by that? So I think it's, again, comes back to this provenance thing. If we just have it at the forefront of our mind constantly, that no matter how wonderful collectors or institutions are, no matter how flattering the job opportunity that we get publishing, we just can't touch it if it is unprovenanced. And because we are scholars, we are the ones that really need to be aware of this issue. And so even if it is then difficult to decline an offer to be the first to publish something, we really should. Even if that's our only chance to get our name out there, because really, would you want your name on something that proves to be illegal or best case fake?
I think you raised like a really good question with responsibility and ideology. I think back to you mentioned earlier, you know, the gospel of Jesus' wife. I think the issue was, it just feels like Karen King was sought out for that. There was enough of the fragment that would pique her interest and scholars. And I think you're right. When it comes to us as scholars, we need to be very careful. We need to make a choice of what we're going to do, whether we're going to work with provenance material or whether we're not. And I think there's a big debate about that, whether we should. And I agree with you. I think it's well too tempting for us to try and be, like you said, the first one to touch it, the first one to publish it. You made a comment really earlier that I found fascinating. You said that we shouldn't have to prove that something's real. Or no, we shouldn't have to prove that something's fake. But that, you know, the onus should be on, we should know the provenance and we should know that it is real before we start publishing it. Like, I talk more about like what you would say to scholars who are in that situation. Like, what would be your advice? What would you say to scholars when it comes to provenance or it comes to, you know, dealing with these sorts of materials?
Oh, that's a big question. I think I'm learning from greater minds on this. It's definitely something that I've been made aware of by others. But at the same time, I think, I mean, in some paper presentations or in some conversations, it keeps coming up that, you know, well, we can't miss out on this because if it is real, it is such a treasure trove of information to the past. And so that's sort of the argument that maybe keeps popping up in favor of publishing is, but we can't miss out on this opportunity to learn about the past. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of difficult to argue against because, of course, yes, if it is real, it is valuable information about the past. But I mean, the end really doesn't justify the means. And so if it has come to me illegally, I still don't think it would be right to do it, even if that means that we're losing historical information. Because then I think the question would be, are we losing this information because I'm not publishing or because we've created a market for illicit trade? Mm-hmm. So I think it's sort of, to put the blame where it's supposed to be, it's not the scholar who is careful with unprovenance material, but it's really the whole scholarly community that hasn't been, that is the problem. And we really are losing more information about the past than we're gaining by playing so loosely with provenance. Because when sites are looted, it's not, you know, the excavation, let's call it, by the looters is not done in the same way as archaeologists. They're not using the same careful methods, and we're not getting information about what material was found next to what material, how was it placed, where was it placed. And so once there's a market for looting and destroying these sites, we're losing more information than we're gaining. So I think in the long run, we will actually learn more about the past if we just don't touch it, because then perhaps we can stop this looting.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, it's, you know, you pose the question about responsibility. I think that's a really tough thing. I think we can't, obviously, as scholars, we can't control what looters do or what collectors do. But I think, you know, if we choose to do what is ethically right, that can have a large impact on, for lack of a better term, you know, the food chain of this. And I think, you know, while we can't control some things, there are things we can control. And I think we need to control some of those things. I think we need to be people that are going to be a little bit more ethical in whether we are publishing or not. And it is really good to see that Brill pulled that volume, and that people are beginning to raise these sorts of questions. And I think a lot of it, you know, obviously there's the high profile cases of, you know, the Gospel of Jesus' wife, but I think also these, you know, the post 2002 fragments raise that as well. And I think, you know, that has been a large part of it. Tell me a little bit about the Schoyen collection. I know you talked about the Museum of the Bible. What about that collection? Where did that come from? How did they come across those? And what did you learn by looking at those fragments?
I mean, that's interesting because it's such a different collection from the Museum of the Bible collection. The Museum of the Bible is much more, I mean, they have a religious, for lack of a better word, agenda. It's a very clear ideology behind it. Whereas the Schoyen collection, the man behind it is Martin Schoyen. He is a man from a little bit outside Oslo, the capital of Norway. And he has this huge collection of ancient artifacts and manuscripts mainly. And it's, I mean, his like Dead Sea Scrolls portion of it is just a tiny bit of what he has. He has much more like Buddhist artifacts and a lot of other stuff that would be fun to talk about as well. But he is, I suppose, more, I don't know him personally, but he seems to be more sort of historically interested. And he's like a collector's collector, sort of, a collector to the bone. So very interested in kind of preserving the past and actually making it available to the world. He's been very generous with scholars to give them access to publish. I'm sure if someone wrote to him and wanted to have a look at his material for scholarly purposes, he would probably be happy to grant access. But there are problematic aspects of his collection as well, because like with the Museum of the Bible, he does have some forgeries, like we've talked about, but he also has a lot of unprovenanced material. And a lot of this has been something that's come up in the media. I mean, there's a documentary from 2004 in like the Norwegian official broadcasting TV station that was so long, it had to be two like documentary episodes because there was so much material. And he's under investigation right now, actually, for some material. I believe it was from Iraq. And he's supposed to return that. So it's sort of a similar story when it comes to kind of the lack of interest in provenance. But it's a different story, perhaps, with how he's using them, because it's less of an ideological thing and more of just this great interest for preserving and owning and showcasing. Yeah, I don't know if that answered the question, but
no, I think you're right. You know, the Schoyen collection has kind of a different feel, I think, than the Museum of the Bible. I think you hit it on the head, you know, about ideology. You know, I'm at Azusa Pacific University. We have some, and for those of you who can't see, air quotes around fragments, you know, and I know for us, in the purchase of those fragments, there was a lot of question. You know, some of the people who wrote in that Brill volume are friends and colleagues of mine. And I understand how difficult it is to be, you know, asked to do those things and wanting to publish and wanting to have your name out there and then having, you know, this sort of conversation happen. But I know for us, they were a bit of offering us bona fide in like being able to say, oh yes, we, you know, we can research, we have these fragments, but, you know, of the ones that we possess, one of them actually is not a biblical text, which I found fascinating. And that has garnered zero interest. I think it goes back to what you're mentioning about, you know, like such a small amount of these texts being quote biblical, you know, from the pre-2002 and then the post-2002, you get the market flooded with these biblical texts because that's the hot commodity. That's the thing that everybody wants, you know? So I think that thought about, you know, ideology, is really, really important. I think it's really important for us to kind of try and answer that question of, you know, how are we dealing with these and how are we propagating this ideology that we maybe don't want to? I don't know. So.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I would love to look into other collections and institutions fragments as well. I guess that'll be a next project.
That'll be the next project. I know.
Fragments and manuscripts and scrolls. Why do we call them scrolls?
Yeah.
When we have manuscripts and fragments that are apparently cortex sized.
Yeah, I think this is such a central question. Because often, at least in like public media, when we talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls, we always talk about the number of scrolls. And so when a new fragment is found that is not tied to any other fragment or identified with any other fragment, then that little fragment is counted as one entire scroll. So statistically, it has the same impact as, for example, the Great Isaiah Scroll. And this becomes a problem because, of course, we don't know exactly. I mean, it's based on very educated reconstruction, all of this, but ultimately, there's only so much you can reconstruct with very just broken material that has decomposed over time. And so this, like, the way that we talk about it, even in, like, small circles in the scholarly world, is often we talk about this and that scroll instead of this and that fragment. And it can sometimes, in collections, create the illusion that some collections have this vast material because, for example, oh, we have 11 scrolls, when in reality they're stamp-sized fragments. So I think that's a problem, both with regards to kind of what does the public and what does sort of everyone that reads these presentations, what do we understand that these collections own? But then there's also, the problem in like our own papers and everything that we keep talking about scrolls and manuscripts when we really mean fragments. But of course, even the word fragment is difficult because at what time do you count it as a fragment? If it's a, you know, concrete physical entity, then do you count it at the time it was found and first photographed? Or now that it's decomposed later into five parts, is that now five fragments or is it still one fragment? If there are three fragments that were found and that, you know, you can clearly see that, oh, these are one, these came from the same thing. You can piece them together like the, you know, the famous comparison with a puzzle. You can puzzle them together. Is that one fragment or is it three? So it's, I mean, this is all just difficult and complicated. But I think just us being transparent about what we're talking about solves a lot of the issue. Like, you know, if I'm talking about a fragment, to say that, well, this fragment specifically three fragments, A, B, and C. But it was once one fragment, for example. So yeah, clarity about that. But
I think the language can be really imprecise. I my hunch, of course, you know, this is very, totally anecdotal probably, but I think sometimes the word scrolls gets attached to it because the first seven that were found in the first cave were very extensive scrolls. You know, and I think that then overshadows the whole conversation about fragments and manuscripts. And like, you know, I mean, obviously we have the War Scroll, which is cave one. The provenance on that is pretty interesting in that, you know, they, when they found it, and obviously it comes out in the first seven, you know, it came from cave one. Well, they were led back to a cave that was supposedly cave one, and they did find two small fragments that do match the War Scroll. So it does seem that the War Scroll came out of that cave, but is that actually cave one or is that some other cave? So I think we still are very dependent, shall I say, on the early strata of scholarship in looking at these things. What was published in DJD, and I know that there's, you know, some current projects underway that are going back and revising some of those earlier volumes because we know that there were some mistakes made or there was misidentification, and now we've, you know, kind of cleared those things up through scholarship, which I think is really interesting, which is, I think, you know, Ingrid, a part of your PhD is kind of looking at DJD as a whole too. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about that. Like, what are you learning even about the journey of the scrolls, you know, when it comes to that and it's their publication in DJD, what are you learning?
Oh, thank you. I'm learning, I think, that it's messier than I thought. I guess I naively expected there to have been like some committee starting a project and having like clear guidelines. And of course, that's a very silly expectation because that's not how any book project starts or any publication series start. But yeah, I think in general, so my project is, as you say, on the publication history of DJD and specifically editorial practices. And right now I am working on the like purely history chapter part of it, mapping out the publication history. And it is quite complicated. Just, you know, changing political situations like we talked about before, but also like how is the team shaped? We have documentation of how the Cave 4 team was first started by DeVoe and Harding. Well, Harding was the one who actually started it, and then DeVoe sort of led it, but they were really a duo. But then kind of the expansions of the team after that, there's not a lot of, well, there might be, but I still haven't come across any like clear documentation of how are these contributors chosen. And like, yeah, so all of that is very, very interesting. And I think one of the things that when you're talking now that I come to think about is these narratives that we kind of just adopt and then we keep repeating them until they become truth, which makes the publication, well, not necessarily the publication history, but like the general Dead Sea Scroll history seem neater than it is. So there's this, you know, our narrative that we have about the Bedouin shepherd, who the goat that ran away, and there's always a goat, of course, in all of these like origin stories for anything that was ever discovered. So there was this goat that, you know, ran into a cave and this shepherd boy threw a rock and he heard the clay jar shatter. And of course, we all know that that's probably not how it happened, but it's still the narrative that we keep repeating because it's, you know, it's such a cute story. So, and it fits because that's, as I say, it's a narrative that's repeated for other discoveries as well. And I think this is like the origin story, but we have other narratives as well that we keep repeating. And one of them, Kat, you mentioned before with like, you know, some collections and institutions that still have these fragments that we now know are forgeries, but they aren't necessarily flagged as such. So that's also kind of a narrative. You know, it's much cooler to say we have real Dead Sea Scroll fragments than to say we intended to buy Dead Sea Scroll fragments, but in reality, we bought burnt cornflakes. And so, yeah. I think there are narratives like all along.
And I think it gets you out of like some difficulty of like, if the kind of overarching narrative is, oh, the shepherd went in and found this
the goat got lost. It does sound like this beginning to a bad joke. I was, it's kind of like a priest walked into a bar and did X, Y, Z. Like, it does start like that, but it almost kind of minimizes kind of the nasty issues going on in the background. You have that kind of overarching narrative about, oh, this kind of pastoral image of a shepherd going along, finding these fragments. What luck is that? Like, oh, God, we've got great luck. But actually, there's probably a really, especially 1946, 1947, if you think about a time in the Middle East, actually the history of war and colonialism that's underlying that narrative that we can almost ignore and pretend doesn't exist.
It's a very innocent version of looting.
Yeah, and it's palatable. It's the palatable looting story of it all. And I think it's a bit like Indiana Jones. Indiana Jones does looting very nicely because it's an attractive man that does all these like great adventure things.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it's like so romanticized, right? It's a goat. Right? And it's, oh, everybody loves a goat. Goat story, everyone, you know? So, yeah.
This, and it's like, even when we have photographs of, you know, the alleged Bedouin who first supposedly found these, even with like photographs of him, it's like, this is the man who claims to be Muhammad al-Din. So, you know, it's, yeah, there are some problems with our narrative, I think. And of course, he could have been the one to discover it, but he probably wasn't chasing a goat.
I mean, I think also for me, it gives me great memory of kind of like the nativity story you're told every year, right? The shepherds going. And so you build up this picture of what that kind of, what firstly, what life in the Middle East is like and what life is like in the, like, Dead Sea in Israel. And then you can layer on top of that and it creates this like fantasy of what actually happened.
Oh, yeah.
I think it fits into a nice rhetoric of how we want to perceive the origins of these scrolls, and we want to like eradicate ourselves from this story, or our kind of Western history from this story, and make it a nice pastoral image. But then the good archaeologists went in afterwards and helped them retrieve all these these fragments of manuscripts. Yeah. Sorry, and we just helped them do what they were planned to do. But we didn't go in there first, and we didn't do any damage. We were just helping them afterwards. And I think there's that kind of rhetoric with it. And there was a great point you mentioned earlier about the kind of prioritization of the text when we go in and find these. We don't think about, when we're talking about forgeries, we don't think about where they were in the place when we go and discover them. We think about the text. And for me, that screams that kind of Western prioritization of the text. And there's a really great article that I think I keep mentioning in every episode of this podcast, but Harry Simon, working at the University of South Africa, has a great article on the prioritization of the text that we have in Western scholarship, and that we see the text as this kind of really important central figure in our understanding of the biblical world and of the Bible, as it were. He's talking about Esther and the Hebrew Bible. And I think that comes through is that when we're making these forgeries, we don't think, or they're not thinking about kind of the provenance and the where was it placed in the findings? Because actually that's not what matters to them. What matters is this authority that the text has. So why do we need to pay attention to anything else? Yeah. And I think, so I can see kind of links between that we're okay talking about the kind of the Christian, especially Western Christian ideology that's behind it all, because I feel like I can see it in different points that you've mentioned of like just popping up all over the place that aren't necessarily always connected together or written as coherent narrative. But I love the shepherd's story. I think that's such a great kind of, it is a great alternative nativity almost, right? A way of starting, the nativity of the Dead Sea Scrolls is the shepherds. But it starts off that story of like how it came to be. And I think, it's really fascinating, but I do love the story.
Yeah, I love that idea of like just that you said about being so enamored with the story, so enamored with the physical scroll itself or fragment, probably better, right? So taken with the fragment that you bypass the whole issue of provenance. And I think, for those of you who haven't read it, the book Veritas, that's written on the Gospel of Jesus's wife, is a fascinating read. And I think it really calls us out as scholars. to really take, really consider strongly, you know, the provenance, because that is the issue, is that, you know, provenance feels like it was just completely ignored in that case, even very problematic issues, because of what this said. And I think that goes back to Ingrid. I think what you said is so important, and I think it's important for all of us to hear, is that if it's too good to be true, it probably is. And I think there is something to that, that like all these scrolls, and I think you said earlier, quote, solve some textual thing where it's like, oh, we've always wondered, you know, this thing was in the apparatus, and oh, look, here we now have something that solves this issue for us or proves this problem or whatever. And, you know, yeah, I think that we have to take provenance much more seriously than we do. And if we do not, I think we do it to the detriment of the field. We do it to the detriment of ourselves as scholars, but I think it's a detriment to the field. And I think we need to definitely be very careful with that.
And I just appreciate so everything that you're saying. And I do want to add that, like, I mean, often, at least when I talk about these provenance issues, I kind of hear myself afterwards having framed it as if this was like something new, as if there were no rules before. And it's like, oh, but now we have these rules because now we know that these things are illegal. But you can see in documents from the very start of the publication of the Dead Sea Scrolls that they were very aware of this problem. And so it isn't, I mean, on the one hand, we shouldn't be like too strict when we judge the past, because hindsight's always 20/20. But at the same time, we also shouldn't excuse everything, because it wouldn't be true to say, well, it, you know, provenance and the legal issues surrounding ancient artifacts, it wouldn't be true to say that that's something that's just appeared like in the last 20 years. It's been there before that as well. And I mean, there often with the unprovenance material, it's like, oh, but it was taken out of Israel before year so-and-so. And then we think it got around, you know, these antiquities laws, but there were antiquities laws before then as well. And so, like, taking something out of Israel before 1980 or 1970, it doesn't really help, because there were still laws in effect. So I think that's also something to kind of take into the discussion of provenance. It's like, the rules were always there. We haven't been great at following them, but that's not an excuse to not start now.
I think this idea of, you know, there's good news and bad news about the biblical text at Qumran. I think depending on your ideology, you might focus on the good news or the bad news. I mean, the good news is, yes, there are texts that seem to have quite an affinity to the Masoretic text. So that becomes a point of emphasis, I think, for some people that want to show continuity. But I think the thing that is often forgotten is the pluriformity of the biblical text at that time. That is not a narrative that some ideologies want you to hear.
But I'm like baffled by that, though, because, and like, I think maybe I'm just slow on this, because, but from my take, it's like, well, so I'm Norwegian. Obviously, the Masoretic text was not originally written in Norwegian. And so it's bad news for my Norwegian Bible if there is not a pluriform text tradition, because that would then say something about, like, you know, it would only be correct if it was, you know, the same letters and the same punctuation as the so-called original text. So I would think that from like a more evangelical or conservative standpoint, or whatever we're choosing to call it, that it would be good news to have like a living text that is able to adapt to different contexts and languages. I've always been baffled by the resistance to the pluriform text tradition.
Yeah, well, I mean, the hesitancy to it obviously is because it argues against some urtext, some original by which everything else might be a corruption or might come from that, or some kind of ideology of inerrancy. But there is great, for certain evangelical traditions, there is a great comfort in knowing that, you know, the English version you read, which is translated from the Masoretic text, is so faithful. Look how far it goes back. But we forget that we have, you know, 4Q Joshua A, right? The which has chapter 8 in front of chapter 5 and has a 5 verse 1 is out. And then there's a statement in there that is different. So we have this huge physical evidence of a text that looks very different for Joshua.
Wait, so someone that with like a minor interest in Joshua, probably like the land settler, I like the 13 to 21. That's kind of my bit with Joshua. But so 4Q, we're talking about K4 and the discoveries found in K4, right?
Yeah, so yeah.
In the Qumran caves.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Sigla works, 4Q would be K4 Qumran, and then usually a number is given to it. But for texts that have been identified or texts that have been given a name, sometimes they will sub that name in for it. So this fragment is called 4Q Joshua A. It's the first of the Joshua fragments. Do we want to, is there anything about Azusa that we want to cover, or is there nothing? I know we were saying about we were going to get back to it. Do we want to, or do we feel like we've covered everything we need? Up to you.
I mean, I don't really know much about Azusa, so I'm thrilled to hear anything that you want to share about it. But I wouldn't really know what to ask about because I just don't know much about it.
No, I mean, Joe said maybe we can do a part two. Maybe there is a part two to this, and maybe we can deal with some of that. But I avoided dealing with our fragments like the plague. Like, I stayed away from those. I wasn't asked to be a part of the Brill thing, but people who wrote for that are friends of mine. I have my own take on it, which may not be popular. They did not choose any Scrolls people. Like, I know people on our staff who wrote for that who are not Scrolls people. And for the life of me, I have no idea why we had certain people writing chapters in there. I could name them by name, probably shouldn't, but really, like, I was surprised at certain people who were writing in that Brill volume. And then I was asked, oh, this is horrible. This will probably open a whole nother can of worms. I was asked by Bobby Duke, who did that, who is our dean, if I would work on the Museum of the Bible Scrolls as a part of the Green Scholars Initiative. And I turned it down. I turned it down.
Good for you.
Because I said, I don't feel comfortable at this time dealing with that collection. And I've got other projects going on.
When were you asked about that?
And I stayed away from it.
When were you asked to do that?
Oh, gosh. I was probably 2017 maybe.
So
17
you were
or
pretty
18.
Early to be aware of these problems then. Because I mean, creds to you for being
so quick to
deny that.
I know. I told Charlotte that. And I said, here's my answer, is that I don't want to attach me or you to that. Like, you know, so I was also thinking of trying to protect Charlotte a little bit too. You know, I was like, I don't want her to be attached to it. But yeah, it might have been 2018. But when they asked me to do it, I said no. And then they moved on and found someone else to do it. But it was, I'll tell you, and this is, I think, why I appreciated what you said. I was tempted. That drive for publication that we have in our field is dangerous.
Because we're measured on it as well, you know?
It is. It's intoxicating.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a draw because we are judged on it. We wonder if it will open a door. And I feel that especially as junior scholars, we are more susceptible to this than I think maybe senior scholars are. But I could be wrong. I mean, I'm now thinking about Karen King and I'm like, that's a pretty senior scholar. But yeah, for us to be able to kind of wrestle with that, it's a very difficult thing. For us to be able as scholars to take our hands off those things, because what if that's the thing that makes my career? What if that is the thing that launches, you know? So I think there is a bit of intoxication with wanting to publish in those fields and do that, but we must stay away from things that are unprovenance. And I think I think back to Jody Magnus and Dennis Mizzi's article. I look at that as the benchmark article, for Provenance.
We should link to that if that's possible.
Yeah, we totally should.
This seems like a wildly better area to be researching in, like wildly more scandalous. Like,
if you want scandals, then yeah, it's definitely.
That's what keeps you going.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the thing that needs to be written on, Ingrid, you talked about it, and Eustace is kind of thinking about this, but it's these lost fragments.
Yeah.
The ones that are lost. Yeah. I think that is the next spot of, like, why are these things that we have photographs of now missing?
I mean, that's so another. I that's another. Thing. They're following my supervisor Ursten Justness. He is doing this on Twitter. It's, I think, almost every day.
I'm watching him do it. That's what I'm thinking about.
I think it's like hashtag daily loss or something.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And it's incredible. I don't know how many he's up to now, but the last time I asked him, he was at 400 something lost fragments.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a ridiculous number. And that's only from a few volumes.
Yeah. Which then really says something about the Dirk Obing thing, right? Dirk is selling off Oxford fragments. Have these been sold off privately? Were they pilfered and then sold off? And they're sitting in someone's collection, and they actually are legit, but they were illegally sold out of that. So, you know, there's a whole thing right there of just like, where are these missing fragments going? You've been listening to Ancient Afterlives. If you want to contact us, you can email ancientapodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter. Thanks for listening.